we actually made an initial, what we call an incubation grant, which is this separate piece of our work where we're trying to help build potential future top charities and to improve our understanding of our current top charities. And so we made a GiveWell incubation grant to No Late Season back in 2014. Since we didn't think at that time that they were quite evidence-backed enough that we were comfortable recommending them as a top charity, since we have, you know, we want to see a lot of evidence. As I mentioned, we have like pretty strict criteria. We're really looking for organizations with a very strong case of impact. And No Late Season was very new. But we provided this incubation grant funding in 2014 and followed their work for the next few years until we got to 2017, when we felt that they were operating at a sufficient scale and had the type of track record that we could assess for a potential top charity recommendation. And so this year we spent a lot of time asking them questions, really modeling out their cost effectiveness, figuring out how much additional funding they need, and then also doing a site visit to Bangladesh, which I was fortunate to join. So checking out the program on the ground, watching how it works, and asking lots of questions. Basically spending a week asking Evidence Action and their implementing partner, RDGRS Bangladesh, as many questions as we could possibly think of. So that was how No Late Season joined our list. And then Helen Keller International's Vitamin A Supplementation Program, I kind of quickly hinted at this earlier. They were implementing a program that we were very interested in for a while, vitamin A supplementation, and Chelsea Tabart, who's the research analyst who's been leading our charity outreach work, reached out to them to potentially apply with this program. And so we spent the year, you know, similarly really trying to understand the program, understand you know, the evidence base for vitamin A supplementation better, and modeling out the cost effectiveness. And then finally, we believe that there was a funding need this year, in particular because the Canadian government had scaled down funding that it had been providing for this program. So we saw that additional dollars could really have an impact here. So Helen Keller International, we also did a site visit there to their work in Guinea to observe a vitamin A supplementation distribution, and that's kind of how that organization also joined our list. So those are the two newest additions to the GiveWell group. And some of the considerations that we would recommend, you know, as donors, keeping in mind, you know, I mentioned that for one, our cost effectiveness models involve some uncertainty, and that uncertainty can reflect a few different things. One is sort of the ways that staff members at GiveWell trade off increasing income relative to improving health. So, you know, I said our top charities work on programs with pretty different outcomes. That trade-off between health and income is a quite subjective one at this time, where staff members will input their own best guesses as to how to trade this off, and we're actually working on a project to get more information about how to make those trade-offs that I'll talk about in a moment. But, you know, if you're a donor thinking about giving to one of the nine charities we recommend, and you feel very strongly that, you know, improving someone's health is sort of the number one most important thing to you, you might want to choose to support one of the charities that we recommend that focuses on that rather than, you know, deworming or No Late Season or give directly, or, you know, the opposite may be true. So that's sort of one thing to keep in mind. The other kind of major point to keep in mind if you're considering which of the charities to support is sort of your feelings about the certainty of an evidence base that you would want to see. So the top charities that we recommend are all very evidence-backed, and we feel that they are all outstanding, but they don't have the same types of evidence bases behind them. So what I mean by this is that if you want to really know that your dollar is going from, you know, point A to point B, that you might make different choices about which GiveWell top charities to support. And so sort of on the spectrum of most certain case for impact to most speculative case for impact, we have Give Directly on one side, which is a program where you're just giving people money. There have been many randomized controlled trials done of this program. Give Directly itself has excellent monitoring, and there's kind of a very clear case for where those dollars go. Somewhere in the middle, we have the malaria charities, so the Malaria Consortium and Seasonal Malaria Chemo Prevention, also have been studied quite extensively in academic research. You know, the research might be a little bit older, maybe malaria burdens are a little bit different where they're working, You know, they also have good monitoring, but the case is slightly less certain, I would say, than like the give directly cash transfer case. And then on the farthest side, we have the deworming groups that we recommend, where we rely very heavily on one randomized control trial that showed a very large impact on incomes for children who receive deworming later in their life. We discount this study quite heavily, and I'm happy to talk more about the reasons for that, but it's really like the single piece of evidence that drives a lot of our recommendation, and we've spent a lot of time trying to figure out what's going on with this evidence and how it holds up. And we do think that it's continued to hold up against our scrutiny, but it's not the same level of certainty as something like the Against Malaria Foundation or GiveDirectly, where there are multiple randomized control trials that point in the same direction. Our recommendation of deworming is really based on having a very cheap intervention with a potentially very large impact. So even when we discount the potential that the impact wasn't as large as in that main study that we rely on by huge amounts, like 90%, it still comes out to be one of the most cost-effective things we've ever seen. So certainty is sort of another thing you might want to have in mind as a donor. And I should say...
Where does the vitamin A supplementation fall in?
I'd say vitamin A is probably somewhere like between Give Directly and the malaria charities. We have some questions about how the vitamin A deficiency levels in the areas where Helen Keller International is operating compared to the areas where the vitamin A studies were done in the past. And also the fact that there's kind of this large number of studies that were done in the 80s and 90s of vitamin A supplementation, and then a very large, more recent study, those studies showed that it reduced child mortality from illnesses, then a very large, more recent study that didn't find an effect. And so we spent a lot of time thinking about that question. And so that was kind of a factor in us figuring out that we did want to recommend vitamin A supplementation, and we weighed that. But that would be my best guess, would probably be somewhere between like GiveDirectly and the malaria charities. And I should say, with all of these like donor considerations, one thing is that we're really happy to talk through giving decisions. And so if you're thinking about what do my preferences mean for what I should support, or what does GiveWell think about, you know, for donors who feel this way, we're really happy if you reach out to us to help talk through those decisions, or, you know, provide more detail on sort of why we recommend what we recommend, and which maybe values would lead you to also choose directly or to donate to that place. So just finally, so I want to leave plenty of time for questions. I wanted to talk about two of kind of the elements of GiveWell's future. The first is GiveWell incubation grants. So I mentioned that No Lean Season came through GiveWell incubation grants, and that this is a piece of our work where we're actively trying to grow the pipeline of potential future top charities and to improve our understanding of our current top charities. And so the sort of thinking behind incubation grants, which started in 2014, was that we weren't seeing a lot of turnover in our top charities list just by going through our standard process of looking for organizations that have a lot of evidence pre-existing behind them and very long, strong track records that we could assess. And so we wondered whether we might be able to get involved as a funder a bit earlier to, you know, develop organizations that seem promising, since the groups that we were assessing had been generally funded by someone else before they got to us, such that they could develop the type of track record that GiveWell requires for our recommendation. And so we made a number of grants. These are supported by Good Ventures, a large foundation that we work closely with, as part of our incubation grants program over the years. And we're really excited about this work, and we've sort of made it a bigger piece of how we're spending our time, because we feel like we're now able to kind of think about the research questions that are most important to us and that could really shape our recommendations, and to identify organizations that seem, you know, really promising, like No Lean Season, and to, you know, support them such that we can, you know, answer questions that we have or recommend things that we haven't recommended previously. And one of the ways we're doing this is through a partnership with a group called ID Insight. And ID Insight is a group that provides social impact information sort of on the ground to policymakers and decision makers. And what they can do is kind of be a research partner for us that's operating in the field. So they can run a randomized control trial if we have a question that, you know, we would like to run a randomized control trial on, or they can do a survey. In this case, you know, one project that I mentioned is that our cost effectiveness figures rely on these moral trade-offs that are, you know, how do you think about income versus health? And that's a really hard question. And some information about this exists in terms of how people make those trade-offs in rich countries. Most of the research that's been done on sort of how people, you know, generally value income and health trade-offs, that exists for wealthy countries and does not generally exist, as far as we can tell, for the countries in which GiveWell's top charities operate, so some of the poorest parts of the world, where you can imagine maybe people make trade-offs differently. And so one of the projects that we're working on with ID Insight is a survey of beneficiaries of GiveWell top charities, or potential beneficiaries of GiveWell top charities, to better understand how they would make those trade-offs. So that's, you know, one type of project that we're excited about too, working with ID Insight, since I think that will really help inform our recommendations. And then finally, one of the other kind of major pieces of our work going forward is on GiveWell's outreach work. So historically, you know, GiveWell is 10 years old this year, and we've historically put very little focus on sort of proactive outreach about GiveWell's work. We've been really focused on building up the research product, and we feel like that product is now both quite mature and identifying more funding opportunities, than more high-value funding opportunities than we're expecting to fill with our current sort of projected donor growth rates. And so we're now thinking a lot about how we can improve our outreach and reach people who might not have heard of GiveWell before, but would be interested in using our research. And so we've been working on a number of different projects there. Some of the biggest projects, one of the biggest, is on an experiment that we're running in podcast advertising, where if you listen to The Weeds or 538, or Rationally Speaking, you might have heard an ad for GiveWell in the last few weeks. That was the result of us running an experiment in February of having a couple ads run on those podcasts and seeing a really good return to that, and thinking that, you know, that was something that was worth trying during the giving season, during the time of year when most people are making charitable giving decisions. So that's, you know, one type of outreach project that we're working on. We're also interested in, so that's kind of the marketing category. We're also interested in things like improving GiveWell events. So we'll be sending a survey, and it would be a great help if you can fill that out, thinking about different types of events that would be helpful to have. Thinking about our media outreach, since lots of, you know, GiveWell's donors have found us through media coverage that we've received. And so generally just kind of running experiments in the space and trying to figure out what works for us, what doesn't. We're quite new to it, but you know, this has become kind of a major organizational priority, and so we're trying to do more of that going forward as well, to learn from the initial work that we're doing in this space, and hopefully, you know, develop a robust outreach plan going forward. So I'm going to pause there. So I've been talking for a while, and I would really like to answer questions that you have. So as I mentioned, I'll repeat them for the sake of the recording, and yeah, feel free to ask about any of that or anything else I didn't mention.
So it sounds like a requirement for getting attention from GiveWell and getting a recommendation is that your intervention has been studied academically. And so are you aware of any biases in the kinds of things that academics study that might be neglecting, like, high-impact causes or interventions?
Yeah, so are we potentially sort of having a biased set of research that we're considering if it's coming out of academia, since that is a requirement for us? So when I say academically too, I just mean independently studied. So there are some groups that are either affiliated with academic institutions or sort of separate research organizations that focus on global health and development. So it's not just kind of traditional academia that we're looking at, but kind of more broadly. You know, I think an important question is whether we're missing out on things generally that could be better than our top charities by focusing on, you know, what's measurable or what can be studied. And, you know, Holden will talk about some of the work that the Open Philanthropy Project is doing, which is kind of in a different category of evidence in some cases, where they're open to things that are a bit more speculative than GiveWell. So GiveWell is really focused on providing sort of strongly evidence-backed and vetable recommendations. And when I say vetable, I mean we want to be able to make a very strong case for anyone who sees our research as to why we recommend something. So even if you don't read all the footnotes, you can check them and, like, see that there's a strong case there. And so for us, the ability to study and measure something is a really important prerequisite, because we do want to be able to make this sort of strong case toward why we recommend what we recommend. That being said, we are interested ourselves, as I mentioned, in the incubation grants program, in actively funding research into things that seem promising but maybe haven't been studied yet. And so, you know, we are interested in having conversations, you know, to point toward things that we would love more information about but doesn't currently exist. And so I think that, you know, we're trying to generate evidence in some cases where it doesn't exist, but we would like to see it.
So you mentioned that you're looking for charities that are like 2 to 3 times more effective than GiveDirectly. Why that 2 to 3 multiplier? Like, I would expect you to be okay with things that are like at least as good as GiveDirectly.
Yeah, so why do we look at something that might be 2 to 3 times as good as cash or GiveDirectly when we're looking at recommendations? So it's not a hard and fast rule, as I mentioned. You know, we don't think our cost effectiveness estimates are precise. And so that's why we look for things that kind of have like 2 to 3x different instead of just 0.25 times as good as cash transfers or something like that. Okay. And that's earlier in our process when we're sort of prioritizing among potential interventions. Mm-hmm. And we often see the cost effectiveness of things get worse the more time that we spend learning about them and thinking about our uncertainty and putting in our inputs. So I would guess that if something is as good as cash transfers in our kind of initial take on it, that it will potentially end up being worse than cash transfers. And we want to sort of really solidly beat GiveDirectly, since we do think that it is an excellent organization with a lot of room for more funding. And so, you know, I think that we're trying to aim to like really find things that are much better than cash rather than kind of equivalently good, because we do think that there is so much room for more funding. If we had a scenario where something ended up being around as good as GiveDirectly, I'm not sure that I could say what exactly we would decide. Like if it started out at 10x cash and ended up around the same, you know, after doing our big deep dive into its cost effectiveness. So far that hasn't happened. A lot of the interventions that we found end up this year have ended up like around the like 6 times as cost effective as cash transfers range. And we're trying to prioritize finding things that might be significantly better than that. So I don't mean to be too precise when I say 2 to 3x. That's just kind of like a rough heuristic when we're in the earlier stages of prioritizing what to look into to help us kind of gauge how promising something is.
And it sounds like you expect there to be interventions that are much more effective than that, and so you're looking for those.
Yeah, so we're hoping, so we found a lot of things where like the marginal dollar appears like it'll be around 6 times as cost effective as cash transfers. And we think that there's probably a lot of room for more funding in that space, in that range, based on what we found recently. And we are trying to think of what would beat that, where we could find opportunities that would be significantly better. Our current best guess is policy advocacy in low and middle income countries, because you can imagine putting in a relatively small amount of dollars, having a policy passed that affects millions of people, and it might be extremely cost-effective. So we're planning to prioritize some research into that in 2018. Whether we'll be able to identify opportunities or sort of make the strong enough causal case that we want to recommend that, I'm not sure at this point, but that's kind of our best guess for where things that are significantly better than this kind of cluster of cost-effectiveness that we found would be.
Okay, thank you.
So over what time horizon are you looking at impact? Like I think about the healthcare stuff and like malaria and that same stuff in the interim, obviously, but like disease eradication, which can be more expensive up front, but over time may save many lives.
So what time horizon are we looking at for impact? So for the things that we currently recommend, there is actually quite a variation. Since the deworming treatments that I mentioned, we think that the main impact is 10 years out. And so with something like disease eradication, I think that type of question would probably come down more to the evidence piece and sort of how confident we could be that funding a particular thing would lead to a disease being eradicated. I think that would be more of the challenge than something like, you know, an expectation that would occur over a 10-year time horizon. Since we're comfortable with that kind of time horizon, if there's an evidence base that suggests that that's, you know, where the impact is.
Hi, I'm very excited by the outreach efforts that you're currently making. That initial round of podcast advertisements, for example, did seem to target people who are inclined to, let's say, evidence-based policy decision making. Do you have ideas or interest in pursuing how to persuade people whose basis for their charitable giving might not be that framework?
Yeah, so our initial outreach effort seems to focus on donors who might be data-minded already or potentially kind of already thinking about giving in this way. Do we plan to or have an idea of how to reach people beyond that? So I think our initial thought is that it makes sense to focus on people like our donors. So we chose the podcast that we chose to advertise on because we talked to a lot of donors about what they were listening to, and those were really common options. And so we thought we have a sense that not everyone who might be interested in GiveWell has heard that we exist. And so we should start with people who are sort of most likely to give through GiveWell if they hear about us, and then to kind of broaden from there. It seems like a reasonable starting place for us, but I'm not sure what we're gonna learn out of all of these experiments. Maybe we'll find out everyone who's already potentially, everyone who's the most likely to give to GiveWell is already giving to GiveWell. We don't think that's true just based on the outreach that we've already done, but we might learn that. And so then we'll have to probably get into the trick here. How do you reach brand new people who are giving in very different ways?
Hi, you talked about looking into funding for new research into new interventions, and you also spoke about how you wish there was more research for your existing interventions. Have you thought about funding research for those?
Yes, great question. So have we thought about funding research into things that we already recommend? Deworming is probably the best place where we're really thinking about this. There's also against malaria foundation work. So I guess I'll start with that one because it's shorter and then get into deworming and hopefully be able to explain it in a short amount of time what we're thinking about with that. So with the Against Malaria Foundation, we're funding ID Insight, that group that I mentioned that we work closely with, to work on a project to address some of the questions that we have about their monitoring, which we wrote a blog post in 2016 where we talked about some of the questions that we realized we had about the way that the Against Malaria Foundation was doing those checkups that I mentioned after they do insecticide-treated net distributions to visit villages and visit households that receive them and see if they're still hung and what condition they're in. So we raised some questions about the methodologies by which they were doing that. ID Insight is now working on a project to both better understand how the Against Malaria Foundation is doing that and to work with them to improve that. So that's one project. And then on deworming, where I mentioned we rely very heavily on this one study, which we spent a lot of time looking into, I think this is the place where we would probably be the most excited to see additional evidence. And so we made two additional incubation grants in the deworming space in 2017, one to fund a 20-year follow-up study of consumption for people who received deworming treatments as children. And then the second to look into whether there were studies that were done 10 to 15 years ago of deworming where maybe those studies had like a 1 to 5 year follow-up and whether we could revisit recipients of those studies 10 to 15 years later and see whether they also find this income effect that we see that's really surprising, that it would be interesting to see if other studies also found that effect. And so that was another like smaller grant that we made just to kind of get an initial sense of whether that information could be collected. I think we're pretty unsure about that one going anywhere, but those were two of the things that we are trying to learn more about deworming. David Rudman, who's a senior advisor at the Open Philanthropy Project and specializes in doing replications of studies that have been conducted, recently published a very detailed blog post on the GiveWell blog on his replication of a hookworm eradication study in the American South that informed a recommendation of deworming. He ultimately concluded that study was not persuasive, so now we have that data point. It's not the core piece of our deworming recommendation, and we continue to recommend deworming, knowing the results of David's research. And now we're in a point where we're thinking about what else we could do. The reason, you might think the obvious thing to do would just be to run another randomized control trial starting now. There are a couple issues with that. One is just the cost of doing so. It would have to be a quite large study to have the statistical power that we'd want to see, and we'd also have to wait 20 or so years to get results, and we're directing funding to deworming now, so we would love to fund something or do something in the nearer term that could improve our understanding of deworming. And so, you know, we've talked about a variety of options, and I think are still, you know, weighing internally whether there are other things that we could do that would change our minds. And with all of them, I think our major question is the cost, and then the probability of the information we get from that study would change our mind. And so thinking about how to you know, square those two things is going to sort of guide whether or not we move forward with any particular thing that we might do to try to understand it better.
Most of the recommendations are for programs of a larger organization. Have you all considered the organizational health of the charities that you're recommending specific programs of? And if there are any long-term implications for those organizations of supporting specific programs rather than the overall operations that gives them the unrestricted support that gives them the flexibility to adapt to changing circumstances?
Yeah, so the question is, you know, many of the programs that we're recommending are for, you know, specific programs that a large charity runs. So we're not recommending the whole charity. We're just saying you should give to this small piece of it. And do we have long-term concerns with the, you know, overall, or do we watch the overall health of the organization such that, you know, are we concerned, you know, that just funneling money to vitamin A supplementation might mean that the overall health of Helen Keller International, you know, is changing in some way that's negative. And this is actually, you know, kind of a broader point is this is a newer situation for us where historically GiveWell hadn't really recommended some programs of larger organizations for the most part out of our concerns with the fungibility and of that money with other programs that the organization was doing that we didn't want to recommend. And so the fact that I think five or six of our top charities are now sub-programs of a bigger organization is a shift for us. And reflects the fact that we feel more confident in our ability to assess, you know, what additional marginal dollars we'll do at those groups. So, you know, part of our recommendation is thinking about, you know, whether the organization will be able to carry out the program in question. So if they are, if they don't have sufficient funding for their overhead in such a way that, like, that would negatively impact the program we're interested in, that should be something that we find out about as part of our, you know, asking about whether they have additional funding needs. And then, you know, I'm not sure whether something like, you know, a program of a large organization that we recommend a sub-program of, let's say this is sub-program A, and there's sub-program B, and then charity C. If sub-program B isn't what we recommend and had to shrink as a result of funding going toward, you know, our recommendation, I mean, that shouldn't necessarily be what would be happening since we're trying to grow the program of interest, sub-program A, by directing more dollars to it. So if something happened where sub-program B shrunk, I don't think we would, by default, try to grow that program since it's not something that we recommend. And so I think we would just want to know whether, you know, the opportunity that we're most interested in is continuing to grow, and if there were bigger organizational issues that would impact that, that would be something we want to be aware of. But we don't sort of, I guess, by default look at the you know, status of all of the programs that an organization is implementing beyond how they impact the sort of sub-program that we recommend.
How do you decide how you allocate dollars between giving money to charities now versus, say, the incubation?
Yeah, so the incubation grants are fully funded by Good Ventures, the large foundation that we work closely with. And so they are, you know, funding that at a particular budget, and then they are also choosing for their own dollars how much to support our top charities. And so, you know, I think right now we feel like we're able to fund the incubation grants that we're identifying at sort of the level that we're seeing. In the future, we might have to start making trade-offs of those dollars, but it's not individual donor dollars that we're trading off. It's this one specific foundation, and so far we've been, you know, able to fund the sort of highest priority incubation grants that we've seen.
A lot of talk about replications of studies and the, your recommendation hinging on the statistical power of the study, or at least, you know, just the you know, that what the study is showing is actually having on the ground. How deeply into the studies are you able to get? I mean, obviously, replicating a study is extremely expensive. Do you have access to the data of the study? Can you get access to the data? Can you reanalyze that? As a skeptical scientist, I know that I can give you associations between any two variables if you give me enough time to run enough regressions on this data. So, or if I clean it the way I want. I'm just curious if that's, if you have a data scientist that kind of does.
Yeah, so the question is, do we have a data scientist that looks at the data when they're doing a replication versus, I guess, us just kind of taking it at its face value?
Or like, if in just even looking over the study that's been done, right? It's been done, this study that claims this 20-year association. If you have access to the data, you can kind of see if you think that statistics that they claim are actually, if you run your model slightly differently, do the results change, right?
Yes. Yep, so that's the type of work that David Rudman is doing that I mentioned,
right,
where he's going back in and trying to look at the original data and, gathering some additional data himself. And so I highly recommend, if you're interested in kind of the specifics of how he does the replications that he's done, I highly recommend reading his blog post that came out, this how he actually did the replication and what he found. So he is looking at that type of information as part of this.
Does he work with for you guys, or are you just a guest blogger? Or
so he is a senior advisor at the Open Philanthropy Project,
right,
and has also worked for GiveWell. So this work that he does is work for GiveWell that he is producing
gotcha.
For us to use.
So there's a question before where you're talking about GiveDirectly versus other programs that maybe work comparably as effective as GiveDirectly. And it brought up for me a question of, is the difference between giving directly, which kind of empowers people to make their own decisions, gives them more autonomy, versus doing things for them, is that something that plays in as a factor?
Yes, the question is, does the fact that GiveDirectly empowers people or gives them autonomy play into GiveWell's recommendation of GiveDirectly? It certainly plays into a lot of donors' decisions to support GiveDirectly through GiveWell. So, it's long been on our list, but it's always been the least cost-effective opportunity that we've recommended, I mentioned earlier. And, I think a lot of the donors who do choose to support GiveDirectly, there's kind of this certainty element that I mentioned that appeals to some, but also this empowerment metric. And I think especially for donors who are very concerned about paternalism and paternalistically deciding what to do on someone's behalf, they will choose to support GiveDirectly. So in terms of whether GiveWell explicitly models that, that's not part of our cost effectiveness analysis, but I certainly think it's a factor that we, mention to donors and that we know that people make decisions based on, so it's sort of one of the qualitative pieces that people use when they're thinking about which charity to support. And I think we just have time for one more. So
I was just curious, of the organizations that you evaluate, about what percent do you not go forward with?
Yeah, so of the organizations that we evaluate, what percent do we not go forward with? It's a little bit of a challenging question because I mentioned that we spend the most time with the organization that seem most likely to succeed. And so it's hard to put a number on it. I think we talked to something like a dozen organizations this year. I might not have that number exactly right, but it's a pretty small number. Like, we're not, talking to hundreds every year. Through GiveWell's history, GiveWell has at least, had preliminary conversations or looked at the website of thousands of organizations, but in terms of groups that we are actively in conversation with as potential top charities, it's a pretty small number because we're really just looking to move forward with those that seem most promising, and we also don't want to take up organizations' time. It's not a good use of our time or their time if they're unlikely to be a good fit. And so, it's a pretty small number that we have serious conversations with, and an even smaller number that we kind of get to interim review stage, which is sort of the next step before becoming a top charity, and then a very small number that we get to, full-on top charity review status. So it's not a very big number per year. And a lot of the kind of winnowing of potential charities we could talk to happens as part of the fact that we, do that program assessment first and say, we're really looking for organizations that work on this set of programs. There are about 20 programs on the list, so it's not a super narrow set, but it's not a very broad set either. And so, yeah, it's a reasonably small group that we end up spending time with. Great, and so it's a little after 7:50, so I think I should call the break here, but I'll be around for the rest of the night, so you can talk to me. My colleague Isabel here is also can talk about Cabell's research, and Caitlin over there. So if you have Cabell questions, feel free to come talk to any of the three of us during the break or after the fact. And yeah, we'll take about a 10-minute break here, and then